Start of the week and loads on the radio, from going vegan on the live line to the drag scene in Cork and learning how to get some sleep. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
What height are you in your heels?
I mean, I'm 6'2" normally, and these are 8 inches.
Oh, so,
I actually just said when I came in, why am I wearing heels on the radio?
Yeah.
But perfectionist.
Now, people might know you from your sausages.
That's right, yeah. Sausages and black pudding and white pudding. But just before I go any further, I had a crisis of conscience there about 6 months ago. And I changed the whole aspect of my business. I'm gone completely vegan.
Happenstance of the years just tilted on his axis, has given us our seasons, has given us our solstices, and indeed even the means to be able to understand our position in the cosmos.
It was the longest day and the shortest night. Summer solstice was marked by Morning Ireland. Audrey Carville was talking to Julie Ní Bhealán, the Dingle Druid.
I got up at dawn this morning. It was actually very dull. But yet it was still very beautiful. The point of the solstice was at 4:32, and there was an awful lot of cloud formations, and there was a lot of wind, so there was a lot of movement in the clouds. But it was still a beautiful dawning, because we are here at the time of celebrating the sun, our sun goddess Lu and Anna. And I suppose at this morning, with the clouds very much, I was feeling into, when we are celebrating the sun, we're celebrating the male energy, the outward energy and action. And then when we celebrate the moon, we have the feminine energy and our intuition and our inward life. So this morning, even though it was very dark, you know, during the time of, I suppose, how we outwardly portray ourselves to the world at this time of the year in solstice, you know, what our manifestations and what we've achieved in life, and that high energy of sun, the high energy of those poor students celebrating, and all of us who want to celebrate now, you know, the gathering of flowers and the bonfires, gathering around the bonfires. And traditionally in Ireland would be St. John's Eve, which is the 23rd, that would be the bonfire night, but okay, also the bonfire would be the solstice.
Kevin, what is the science bit here? What happens on this day?
So basically the Earth actually is on a tilt of 23.5 degrees, and that tilt is constant. But as we move around the sun, our orientation changes. So right here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're tilted towards the sun. So we basically get more sunlight. And as I said, the sun rises very early at around 4:30 in the morning and won't set till after 9 this evening. So giving us around 16 or 17 hours. And then conversely, in winter, we're tilted away from the sun by 20 degrees and we get our very short days and our winter solstice. So these are very important times. As we said, not only, you know, kind of culturally, but also even historically, for example, the development of agriculture, so we could understand the length of the day and plot our seasons and know when to sow certain things. And indeed, so basically our understanding of the Earth's relationship with the sun, its tilt to it, is something actually we've cracked in Ireland even up to 5,000 years ago. And as I said, all caused because we're literally lopsided as we rotate around our axis as we go around the sun.
And Julie, for you, is it all about the land? If we understand this time of year, we understand the land.
We understand the land. It's one of our agricultural festivals. Our last one is 6 weeks ago in Belton. Our next one, which was a fertility festival, our next one in 6 weeks' time is Lunasa, which is the start of the harvest festivals. So at this time, I suppose, it's our connection with nature and the land. And the last couple of weeks, I've come across so many fledging birds, you know, and the risk taking that they take when they make that flight from the nest. And I suppose the high energy of summer and solstice as well, it encourages us to take flight. It encourages us to take that risk. So when we gather around the bonfire, I suppose there's almost there's just a magic when you gather with all the people around the bonfire, or the tinnichnófa, the bonfire, and we connect with our ancestors and we connect with those that went before us, and I suppose the hardships that they went through, our grandparents and great grandparents, and how they went through for us to be here, the privilege of us being here, and we connect with that and we look back. And then we celebrate, so we make daisy chains and we celebrate the flowers and St. John's Wort and Mugwort and Elder and all the blessings of the flowers that we have now. And then we're also at a very important point where the crops for the next 6 weeks, we need good growth. We need a balance of rain and heat
okay.
and sun.
Yeah, and Kevin, the sky is so critical to all we do. And I'm wondering if the Earth's rotation had not been tilted in the way it is, would we have a very different planet, very different seasons?
Yes, we would have had every day the same. We wouldn't have had seasons and we wouldn't have had the changes, as Julie says. So, in fact, this strange happenstance of the Earth is just tilted on its axis has given us our seasons, has given us our solstices, and indeed even the means to be able to understand our position in the cosmos. And whether you're taking that from a kind of a cultural standpoint or a scientific standpoint, they really do meet at the solstices, because they're the times when we understand our position in this, you know, on Earth and its relationship with the sun that basically provides all life and all energy, as Julie says, for us. Whether, you know, you're saying that from a cultural standpoint or even a pure scientific standpoint, they meet in relation to the solstices in the winter and the summer.
And just finally, Julie, how late at night, how late tonight are you expecting there to be light where you are?
Well, last night it was very early because I was supposed to go spend the night in the Blaskets last night, but the weather has been really bad. There was torrential rain. So, I mean, 11 o'clock, you should still have some light outside there. And I just want to say that Grianstaden Tháirg is the Irish for the summer solstice, which means stop. And that's the biggest thing, that this is a 3-day festival every 6 weeks in the Celtic week of the year for us to stop, pause, take it all in.
Dingle Druid, Julie Ní Whelan and Kevin Nolan, physics lecturer at TU Dublin, from Morning Ireland with Audrey Carvel. Then later, Claire Byrne was also talking about the summer solstice with Frances McCarthy, education and outreach officer at MTU's Blackrock Castle Observatory.
I'm a fan of saying this is midsummer.
This is midsummer today.
The middle.
Okay, that makes me feel a little bit sad, you know, that we might be in midsummer. But anyway, we'll take that. We'll take that, Frances. Let's talk about the solstice then, the 21st of June. Why is today the longest day of the year?
Well, it's simple enough for us here in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're on planet Earth. We are spinning around every day, giving us day and night. The length of day and night just depends on which side of you is facing the sun and for how long. Because our planet is tilted over in its orbit, so it's spinning around itself and doing a giant lap of the sun, it's tilted over in the same direction of space the entire year. So half of the year, it's tilted towards the sun, and the rest of the year, after it's gone kind of past the halfway point, our northern hemisphere is pointed away from the sun. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. People are quite happy with the idea that the Earth is tilted as it goes around the sun, but you kind of think, you know, what's it pointed towards? And it's pointed towards the North Star over there in space. So today we are the most tilted towards the sun, which gives us our longest daytime.
Okay. And the further north you are in Ireland, the more daytime you get.
You get even more. So I'm in Cork. Fabulous. We have a long, long day. If I was in Letterkenny, I'd have a longer day. I would have had an earlier sunrise and a later sunset and more hours of daylight. But the opposite happens in winter. So in Cork, in the winter time, we have a short daytime, but it's longer than anybody north.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The earliest sunrise then, Frances, that's already happened, has it?
It has. It happened. That happened last week. So just to add, we have the longest day, but the middle of our day is not exactly when everybody thinks it is. Everybody goes, middle of the day, that's 12 noon-ish.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't. First, we've gone on to summertime. That's changed it by an hour. And we're a little bit further over on the planet from the rest of the time zone, so that makes it more like 1:30. And then even then, there's a little bit of a wobble, which is related to how fast the Earth is moving as it goes around the sun. So we're doing laps of the sun, but sometimes we go a little bit faster, sometimes we go a little bit slower, and that affects the time for the middle of the day. And so the sunrise is sometimes a little bit earlier, sometimes a little bit later than what you would expect. So the earliest sunrise was last week here in Cork. That was at 5:13 a.m. I was not up to look at it. And the time of sunset tonight for us in Cork is 21:57. It's nearly 10 o'clock before the sun goes down. And if you're further north, it's even later.
Yeah, we do really well with our daylight hours in the summer, don't we?
We do. I'm working with people who are in Greece, and of course, they've got the hot weather, the sun. But I say, can you go out at 10 o'clock at night and still read?
And the answer is?
No, they can't, because they're that bit further south. They don't have the same day length. Now, of course, if we were in northern Norway, city like Tromsø, we'd have 24 hours of sunlight.
No, we don't want that. We don't want that. We want to be able to sleep, which we'll be talking about later on in the programme too. So when it comes to the summer solstice then, there is a strong pagan link, isn't there?
Well, this is it. There's an awful lot of connections about determining the solstice, about knowing when the sun would be at its highest northerly point, because, you know, when it's rising, to give it a longer day, it's rising in a different place on the horizon. So there are all sorts of stone alignments that connect to that. There's one in County Kerry that lines to the sunrise of the longest day of the year. The very famous Newgrange lines to the sunrise on the shortest day of the year. So it's got a different alignment. Those alignments, to be recorded in those stone circles, that's not a Christian a connection. It predates Christianity. So there is this strong connection to the position of the sun that was recorded by the people of the time. Now, these were mostly farmers, and so an awful lot of it is, when is the sun doing this? What does that imply about the weather? Do we have our crops in the ground? Can we get them out of the ground in time?
So it's related to the harvest and how good the harvest is going to be.
A lot to do with tracking the seasons, because of their use in knowing about, you know, what the sun is doing is obviously going to affect the weather. We get warmer weather in the summer-ish. Okay.
Frances McCarthy from Today with Claire Byrne, and Ryan Tuberty was also marking an important summer event from 1944.
You might have seen reports of this over the weekend, but I just think I really wanted to mark this woman's this morning, because I knew of it, but I didn't know the full details. And this is Maureen Flavin, who was 21 years old on June the 3rd, 1944. What an important date that is in history. And she dispatched a weather report from Blacksod in County Mayo that would change the course of the Second World War, reading the IrishTimes.com piece on her this morning. And the barometer at the remote weather station showed pressure was dropping rapidly, indicating a major Atlantic storm was due to arrive and blow right across Western Europe. And based on Maureen's readings, Dwight D. Eisenhower, General, U.S. General, postponed the D-Day landing by 24 hours. And on Saturday, Maureen, who's alive and well, Maureen Flavin Sweeney, as she is now, 98 years old, was given a special U.S. House of Representatives honour for her part in the war. And it was recognised at a ceremony in Tiara, a nursing home in Belmullet, County Mayo, where she now lives. Isn't that amazing? What a great connection. With one of the most extraordinary days in the history of the 20th century and beyond. And she was honoured for her skill and professionalism, crucial in ensuring Allied victory, and her legacy will live on for generations to come. Her son is Vincent Sweeney, who happens to be the lighthouse keeper. Isn't that brilliant? At Blacksod Point. And he was proud of the influence, but primarily happy that she got it right. At 1 a.m, June 3rd, the day she turned 21, her readings caused alarm overseas. Later that morning, she received a phone call from an English woman asking that she please check, please repeat the report. She looked at the barometer again, and herself and her husband Ted confirmed that a storm would indeed hit the English Channel on June 5th. And unknown to her at the time, this was the initial date chosen for the invasion of Normandy, France, of course, in an operation that required clear skies. And sure enough, she changed everything.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. Well, here's an interesting one from Today with Claire Byrne, journalist and author Miranda Levy, on her 8-year struggle with sleep, the Insomnia Diaries. So what is insomnia?
The clinical definition is not being able to sleep well for 3 days a week for a period of more than 3 months. That's this kind of clinical definition. But, you know, obviously it comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. You can have a few terrible nights before an interview. You know, maybe if you have a new baby, obviously that stops you sleeping. But where it becomes a real problem is when it goes on and it really affects every area of your life.
And for you, your insomnia was triggered by a single event in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I found out suddenly, really, that my marriage had come to an end. And I had a shock reaction to that. But where most people might get over this, you know, obviously it's a big thing, but, you know, where most people might lose a bit of sleep but sort of gradually get over it, I didn't. And it sort of morphed into a standalone problem with, as you mentioned earlier, when I was prescribed certain medications to try and deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sophie Bostock, who has written the foreword to your book, she talks about the loneliness of insomnia. Can you relate to that?
Oh, that's the problem. I mean, not only do you feel terrible during the day, at night you feel like the only person who's awake on the planet. You know, if anyone's been through this, they'll know what it's like. You stare at the numbers. You know, it's 1:47, then it's 2:46, then it's 3:30, then it starts to get light, and it's horribly lonely.
Mm-hmm. And you get cross with yourself. You get angry with yourself for not being able to sleep.
You do, which obviously makes it worse. Yeah. You know, you're going, oh my God, I've only got 4 hours, I've got 3 hours, I've got 30 minutes. And then you get yourself into a bit of a tiz, don't you? Especially if you've got something important the next day.
And can you talk to us a little bit about how debilitating insomnia is? You just mentioned there that, you know, you feel terrible during the day and you also feel terrible at night. But I know it's difficult to explain this, and you spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about it.
Yeah.
What is the impact of insomnia on you on a day-to-day basis?
Oh God, well, so many things. I mean, I can only talk about my own experience, obviously, but it felt like I was kind of underwater in a different world to everybody else. You know, I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't think. I lost my sense of humour almost immediately. And, you know, tired doesn't cover it, really. It's just like being separate from everybody else and just... yeah, just like a zombie, mm-hmm. really. I lost my job. You know, I lost my job. I, you know, it got very serious. I lost my job. I had problems, you know, family problems, health problems, physical as well, you know.
So every aspect of your life is hit by this.
Yes, I think so.
And then you did what most people would probably do if they're faced with periods of time when in your book you look at the different nights and you record 0 hours and 0 minutes of sleep. So yeah. When you're in that place, you did what we would most of us do, and you go to your GP, you go to doctors, and you're prescribed sleeping pills. Did they work?
No, not for me. They do work for most people a bit, but the problem is the longer you take them, the less well they work and the more you need, because you become dependent on them. There's a certain kind of drugs called benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. So they're the things that have... They're related to Valium, and I actually, at one point, I was on Valium myself. So just to add, my GP actually did the right thing. Arguably, he should have investigated other, like, you know, more talking therapies. But he gave me 2 weeks worth, which is what the NICE guidelines say, the from the medical profession. But what happened to me, I was eventually referred to a psychiatrist, and then all hell went loose. I was really in the pill factory, you know, mm-hmm. and then that's when I really hit problems.
What were you taking then after that?
What
weren't you taking might be easier, but
there's a tablet called clonazepam, which is like Valium but stronger. Lots of different antidepressants, but they'd stop them, start them overnight. You're not supposed to do that. Then antipsychotics, which you give to people who have psychotic illnesses, you know, where they're hallucinating or they're, you know, feeling paranoid, you're often linked with schizophrenia. I was put on those totally inappropriately, which have their own, you know, their own side effects. I mean, some people really need these drugs, and, you know, I'm not an anti-psychiatry person. You know, antidepressants really help some people. Antipsychotics really help some people, but they didn't help me.
And Miranda spoke about the role of therapy in her recovery.
I didn't think therapy was, you know, I was one of those slightly sort of stiff upper lip people about therapy. But yeah, of course, I should have started it sooner. I really should have done. But I wasn't in a position to make good decisions about myself.
But it still didn't work, because your journey was 8 years. That was quite early on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Or else maybe it took quite a while to work. Can you explain to us how it
happened? Well, it couldn't work because I wasn't sleeping. So obviously in psychotherapy, you're meant to reflect on things and, you know, try and work through issues. But because I was so off my head on pills, and that's really not an exaggeration, you know, my lovely therapist, there was nothing he could do, really. So in the end, we had to sort of part company. I mean, he's a friend of mine now. This is what's, you know, but at the time, psychotherapy, I came to it too late, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on the National Health Service in in Great Britain, it's not really offered early on. Yeah, that's another thing. Sorry, the therapist I saw was private, and it's not cheap either.
Yes, and yeah, you can go so far with that if you're paying for it yourself. And as you said there, your job was gone and all of the other issues there too. You checked into a rehabilitation clinic, Miranda. That was in year four?
Yes.
How did that go?
Terribly. Okay. So, I mean, most rehab clinics are set up around the 12-step model for treating alcoholism and recreational drug issues. So the first thing to say about that is physically coming off those things, and alcohol does take a while, but if, you know, several days or maybe weeks gradually detox, it takes a long time to come off psychiatric drugs for some people. You know, I've been coming off one of mine, it's taken me 2 years. Okay, I was taken off Valium in about half my dose, which was significant, in about 2.5 weeks. And you're not supposed to do that. You know, it's not appropriate. As well as, you know, some of the stuff for the 12 steps just wasn't really relevant to my life experience.
Yes.
So that felt a bit alienating. Yes. And again, people are really helped by a lot of this stuff. They really are. It just was not right for me.
Okay. Then after rehab, then you went to A&E straight after rehab.
Yeah. I asked them to drop me there because I just felt so mad. I wanted to go into hospital. You know, most people don't really want to go to psychiatric hospitals as a rule, but I just felt like I had to. I thought, you know, I didn't want to go home. I just, you know, I didn't know what to do with myself. I thought maybe there would be an answer there. But I mean, it's a long story again, but I wasn't there for very long, and there wasn't really. They just kept me on the same pills. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a private clinic where they added in more pills. You know, so I didn't really get anywhere there.
So what eventually did work? Do you know what it was that got you to the point that you're at today?
Well, there are a number of things, really. So I moved where I lived to somewhere that was, you know, less stressful, to use a shorthand. But it took a good 2 years after that before I started to feel better. So the main big reason, I think, obviously, who really knows, is that these pills came out of my system. So my sort of mental state improved just organically, if you like, because I did come off them soon after rehab. But then I was able, so even on sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night, I was able to start doing things that actively helped. So I started exercising. I mean, I know people roll their eyes, but it's really important, especially getting out in the morning. Morning light's very good for managing melatonin. That's the hormone in your brain that sort of regulates your body clock. Other things as well. I came across something called cognitive behavior for insomnia, which has really good strategies. You know, like you were saying, we were saying about the looking at the clock and feeling lonely. Yes. And getting stressed. It helps with that. It's like tips how not to turn your bedroom into a battleground. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't say, that's it, I'm never sleeping again, it's a disaster. You say, okay, I'm having a bad night, but I'm a good sleeper. It'll be okay eventually. I'll get through tomorrow. I mean, that's just one example.
Miranda Levy, her book, The Insomnia Diaries, How I Learned to Sleep Again, is out now. And on the live line, a debate on wild boars and going vegan dominated the afternoon after Katie Hannon got a call from Tracy.
Tracy, you were following that story that was all over the media last week about the family of wild boar that were loose around North Kerry.
Yes, that's right. I was. I felt the story was everywhere, although many people I've spoken to seem to be unaware of it. And that was one of the reasons why I was hoping that your show would pick it up and talk about it this week.
You were concerned about how it was reported and how this was handled.
Yes, I was concerned about what happened, and I'd like to know more, really. I'm not a wildlife expert by any means. I'm just a person who was really saddened and incensed to see these boars killed, summarily executed, really, is what they were. I mean, in some of the reports, it was described that they were euthanized, but that's not what euthanasia is. Euthanasia is termination of a life to end suffering. It's meant to be an act of compassion, and those boars were not suffering. There was a lot of footage of them on social media. You could see that actually they looked very friendly and very tame, and so I can't imagine the situation in which it was decided so quickly to kill them.
Now, I know, you know, reading the reports around this, that there were fears or concerns raised about the possibility that they may be carrying diseases and that this might infect the national herd?
Well, do you mean the national herd of cattle? Is that what?
Or no, of the pigs, as I understand it, yeah.
Okay, well, my understanding is that a large majority of the pigs that are raised in Ireland are raised in factory farms. They're in enclosures. So unless the boers had the keys to the enclosures, I don't see how they were really a risk to the pigs. And my concern is, why wasn't that investigated more? And if there, why couldn't they have been quarantined? Why couldn't there be an investigation in that? Why is our first thought to just kill anything? Why do we have to take that approach? What was the Parks and Wildlife Service doing?
Yeah, well, we did ask the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage have responsibility for this area, we understand. Mm-hmm. And we have asked them for a statement, and we're hoping hopefully before the end of today's programme we will hear back from them for, you know, how exactly they approach this. But your issue really is that there didn't seem to be any discussion around what to do here, that they went straight to killing them.
Exactly, yeah. And it just seems to me to be symptomatic of the attitude that we have here towards nature and wildlife. I mean, we all know, we hear it all the time, we are in a biodiversity crisis. You know, our rivers, our lakes are more and more polluted. We have almost no pristine waterways now. You know, it's just every day there's something in the news about the loss of wildlife, the loss of our natural world, and here we come with some wildlife, and what do we do? It was a family. It was a family of boars. If you look at that footage, it is actually heartbreaking to think. And then there was one, of course, who was left who got away, a large-ish male, I think. And then the news that came soon after that was that he had been killed too. Well, I mean, of course, his family is gone, so what life is there for him? But really, like, what are we thinking? What are we doing here?
Were they wild, though, in the understanding we would all have? Or were they a group of pigs that had kind of broken out from, had been you know, farmed to some degree and had gotten away?
That's a good question. And I haven't seen an answer to that, but that's a very good question. And if they were a group that had broken away, why wasn't there some effort made to find where they came from? Who were their owners? Who had raised them?
Then John Paul O'Connor called Katie. He used to be well known for his meat products.
Now, people might know you from your sausages.
That's right, yeah, sausages and black pudding and white pudding. But just before I go any further, I had a crisis of conscience there about 6 months ago, and I've changed the whole aspect of my business. I'm gone completely vegan.
Oh.
Yes, yeah, because this thing was touching my heart a bit, and I was feeling I had a crisis of conscience about it. And,
what, due to crisis of conscience about killing pigs to make sausages?
Exactly. It was playing in my mind for a while, and I decided to go the other way. So to me, it makes a lot of sense, like, and I completely agree with that, the lady, the previous caller.
Tracy.
There, like, yeah, Katie, yeah. Somebody had a rush of blood to the head and made a very rash decision, like, and should have thought a little bit more about it. To me, seeing it from my point of view, is that I think these were semi-domesticated animals, and why kill them? You know, why you know? I mean, this is absolutely abhorrent. Like, it's outrageous.
I didn't realise, John Paul, that you make vegan sausages now. I didn't realise that was your... It's Sosta is your brand, isn't it?
Sosta is my brand, yeah. But I'm still continuing under Sosta brand, but it's... all my products are vegan. We're working on it at the moment. I completely closed all my operation from using blood and using meat.
And as you say, are you still a meat eater yourself?
No. I gave up meat 6 months ago and I'm completely vegan. So I think this should be a lesson for people as well. Like, if I can turn my business around from using meat to using plant-based food, I think anybody can do it, you know what I mean? And I think that's a road a lot of people should be examining their conscience, like, and putting a lot more thought into it. I mean, I could have continued on, like, and probably had a very good business, but I changed my mind.
What changed your mind, though? Did you have a moment that turned you from meat to this vegan road?
I did. I tell you, Katie, when I was doing it, I demonstrated all over the country, like, in all different in different shops and supermarkets and all that. Like, and the amount of people that was coming up to me and saying to me, you know, that are vegan, and a lot of people got quite insulted, like that I was put my product forward, you know what I mean, as killing an animal and stopping a hat and all that. Like, and I think about it at night time, you know what I mean, and the more people that came up to me, the more I thought about it, like, and the more I thought it made sense, like, you know what I mean. So I could have been greedy and went the greedy way about it, but no, I said after a while I made a decision to go vegan.
Then Shane called Katie about that family of boars.
Shane, I saw the photographs that we're all looking at online. You took one of those, one of the photograph of the family of boars.
I would have seen the boars myself last Tuesday, and I would have seen the remaining boar on Friday morning. Yeah.
And you are a pig farmer yourself, a big pig farmer down in Castle Island, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So can you tell us any more about the thinking behind this and why they had to be dispatched in this summary manner?
Well, I suppose, firstly, wild boar are an invasive species in Ireland. And you had your caller there talking about wildlife. But, you know, they actually aren't wildlife because they are a threat to native flora and fauna. And they do serious damage to, you know, native species, agricultural crops, farmland, and they're vectors for exotic diseases that not only infect pigs, but infect other livestock. And that is why that when there's any sighting that's reported to the authorities, it's followed up on. And, of course, this is the same with every other invasive species in Ireland. It's not just wild boar. You know, many other animals are culled each year because they are a threat to our biodiversity here in Ireland.
Are they wild though? Do we know where they came from? Or did anyone try and investigate that?
Well, you see, in here in Ireland, boars are all their DNA is on a national database, and that was done because it allows the Irish Farmers Association to go and check if pork products in retailers or butchers, etc., are Irish. So if these boar were at any point even legal and legally owned, then their DNA would be on a database, and then it can be traced up who the person was who illegally introduced them into the wild. But in the general area, no, there wouldn't, you know, it's not known that there's someone who had wild boar.
So excuse me, Katie.
Yeah, Tracy.
Were those boars checked? Was that DNA database checked for those boars?
It's currently being done, yes.
So they were shot first and then you're checking their DNA after, is that what you're saying?
But they're wild animals, so how would you expect a wild animal who's also an invasive species to
they don't look very wild. I mean, you saw them yourself, but they don't look very wild. They look very tame and friendly, actually. They were wagging their tails as they approached whoever was taking the video. And they are wildlife. You described them at the beginning as not wildlife, but they absolutely are. Every species of animal that exists on this earth is falls under the umbrella of wildlife, and it is not really up to us to decide who gets to live and who gets to die.
Well,
that's called speciesism, and
that's incorrect.
It's created our downfall, that attitude.
Shane, respond there.
Yeah, I would suggest that caller looks at Biodiversity Ireland's website and reads about the damage that invasive species do to our environment. And also a very important note as well, that the wild boar were roaming around an area which is very ecologically sensitive. It's a special protection area for the hen harrier, and we know that there's no nests in the area.
Yeah.
So those nests would have been destroyed, and that would have caused a devastating impact on the number of chicks that would have been fledged this year. And in particular, the farms in which the animals were roaming in, those farmers are in the hen harrier project. So they're
those boars could not have been rounded up, quarantined, had their DNA checked, investigated who might possibly have been their owners. None of that could have been done. Why couldn't that have been done?
Because they're an invasive species. So you're not going to be taking an invasive species and putting them in quarantine. It's the same with all the other animals that are invasive species.
Who decided that they are an invasive species? Who gave them that label?
That's the legislation. That's the Department of Heritage who look after that.
Shane and Tracy on the live line with Katie Hannon. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Dr. David Nabarro, the World Health Organization Special Envoy on COVID-19.
And I want to start by talking to you about travel, because we have been getting conflicting advice here on what to do. Our Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holohan, last week said that the advice remains for people not to travel abroad for a holiday unless they're fully vaccinated. But the government has said that people can travel once this digital COVID certificate is launched in the middle of next month. And that will allow unvaccinated people to travel if they have their PCR tests in order. What would you advise people to do?
Well, these are all rapidly changing situations, and they reflect the growing willingness of countries to work together on arrangements. I think for now, I would solidly follow the advice of Dr. Holohan and be quite careful about travel. But once the necessary protocols have been agreed between countries and there is a digital certificate coming, and I understand this will be for European countries, then that changes the situation and creates a new playing field in which we will be able to start moving around. In summary, Claire, the quicker that we can have agreements between countries on how to go about things, the easier it is for people to make their plans. And so I agree with all concerned that what we need to be doing is encouraging this coming together between nations so that holiday planning becomes less of a lottery, and we need to encourage that as quickly as possible.
So even if you are not vaccinated, you're saying once that COVID certificate is in place and the PCR locks are there on either side, then it may be safe to travel?
I think it's, let's just be one other thing, Claire, be careful with this word safe. We're always talking here about being aware of the risks and keeping the risks as low as possible. We'll never be in a situation where we can guarantee that travel is without risk of somebody getting infected with COVID or indeed having some other health outcome. But we're talking about processes for reducing the risk. And I think that having the what we're calling the digital COVID certificate is going to make a huge improvement in this.
Okay.
Thank you.
I always ask you about your own travel plans because people are very interested to know what you're doing. And I know that you'd really hope to travel to see family.
Oh, Claire, and here we go. I'll be honest with everybody. I really badly need to see my children, and there are grandchildren I haven't seen at all. They were born just under a year ago, and I haven't been with the family for over a year. And so I've got a ticket booked to go and see them next weekend. But there are all sorts of problems with shifting quarantine requirements, both here in France to do with travel from the UK, but also in the UK to do with travel from the continent. And it's a nightmare to try to work out what will really be possible and whether I will be able to get to see them next weekend. So I'm keeping hoping that I can do it, and I'm organizing all the tests. And I am, I've got a proof of vaccination certificate because I have been vaccinated, but I still don't know whether it's going to work. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of in the same situation as everybody else is, trying to make sense of these regulations, feeling that possibly I shouldn't travel because it's not essential. But for my own sense of well-being, I need to see my children. So I'm in the same pickle as everybody
else.
Well,
yes, and you understand it at first hand, you know, which is very valuable when you're giving advice to people.
Yeah.
The ECDC then has come out to say that the risk of in-flight COVID-19 transmission is very low, and people will welcome that news as we prepare to reopen, whenever that may be, to travel. But air travel is not risk-free, and we should remember that, I assume you'd say.
Yeah, but I do want to really point out to people how important this piece of work from the European Centres for Disease Control is. Basically, it doesn't look as though it's easy to transmit this virus in an aeroplane because of some very definite features of the air conditioning in aeroplanes. And so we're more concerned about what happens when you're not on the plane, when you're in your holiday destination, perhaps doing social in a crowded bar, or perhaps also what happens in the airport before you board the plane or after you get off it. But it's a relief, isn't it, that the actual plane itself doesn't seem to be a place where lots of virus transmission occurs.
Dr. David Nabarro from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, Kin of Queens is a new documentary about a drag family called Machia. House mother Candy Warhol was talking to Ryan Tuberty about drag, glamour and family connections.
When I was a kid, British TV was full of characters like your relative, Danny LaRue, yeah, who was essentially a drag artist. I think probably the first I would have ever seen.
I always say RuPaul before RuPaul.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I think about that, and we'll come on to all of your story in a moment, but was he ahead of his time, do you think?
Completely.
Or, yeah.
That was the time of Liberace and, you know, and also that was the time as well, when you think back, homosexuality was illegal. So they would have said, oh, it's just an act, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I remember Liberace sued the press because they said they essentially outed him. But it was just family entertainment, like straight couples essentially loved him.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, it was a strange, and the British, I always felt, loved drag.
Loved
like
drag.
Always, any opportunity they were jumping into a dress.
Yeah, yeah.
And you wonder, I don't know if it's the same here. Culturally, I wasn't sure if it was the same here.
I think we have a strong history of drag, but you're completely right. Like, British culture was way ahead of us.
Yeah.
I think. If you think back to like maybe when Mr. Pussy was growing up here, was that the 70s or 80s?
Yeah, mostly 80s, I think.
Yeah,
Alan Ansby,
I think people were confused at the start. People sometimes are more confused, but not in the way they were back then. But yeah, like, I still sometimes I'm at old theatres in London or the UK and I'll see his posters and I'm like, this is, I find it mind blowing.
I bet
that he just like had so many sellout tours and such, still so many fans. Like, I don't think that can happen again. Personally.
And he was your
great granduncle on my granddad's side.
Okay, so the close, like it's not like a distant relative to speak of. So all the more cosmic that here we are with you. Will you describe to everybody what you're wearing today? I mean, you've got this big,
blonde kind of 60s updo. Actually, a little bit inspired by one of Danny LaRue's looks, and then a pop art yellow 60s dress. I mean, just what you would wear on a Monday morning at RTE with Ryan Tuberty.
Yeah, yeah. What else would you wear when you're coming in?
What else would you wear?
Going in to see this guy. I know what I'll do. I'll go full Dusty Springfield.
Oh, I love it.
Is that okay?
And look, you're waking people up on the way to work.
Yeah.
You're cheering people up. Even standing outside waiting to come in and, you know, all your colleagues coming in. I love like seeing people smile.
What do people say when they, or react when they see you like that?
I mean, understandably a little bit shocked, and then it'll either go to like really happy and, oh my god, you look amazing, you look great, can I take a photo, which is always really nice.
Yeah.
And understandably then some people might be a bit freaked out because you don't essentially see a 7 foot cartoon woman on the way to work.
What height are you in your heels?
I mean, I'm 6 foot 2 normally and these are 8 inches.
And
I actually just said when I came in, why am I wearing heels on the radio?
Yeah.
But perfectionist.
But I bet like it's like when you know when I put on a suit on a Friday night to do the Late Late Show,
it's
armor, right? You know. So when you were coming in this morning to talk to us as Candy Warhol, if you came in your jeans and t-shirt or whatever,
wouldn't feel the same.
I bet.
Yeah, wouldn't feel the same at all. Yeah, and that's hard to explain to some people. It's not like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde where the wig goes on and I turn into somebody else, but you just said it perfectly. It's like an armor, gives you more confidence. And you also feel more in character because you're feeding off like a performance, like you're the same.
Yes.
You feed off an audience, right?
Yeah.
So it's like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
This documentary is a gorgeous sort of sketch on the world you inhabit.
Mm.
And would you kind of explain to me how the crew works? Because I was saying to you before you came on air, you're traveling around in a camper van.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like a kind of a trippy Scooby-Doo episode.
Love it.
Okay, does that make sense?
I love it. Yeah, that's perfect.
Even your dress today now would say that wouldn't be out of place on Daphne or one of the.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're in this van. How does it work? Because there's a hierarchy of sorts.
I mean, usually, drag houses date back to like the 60s when ballroom started in New York. But so there's always, you know, a house mother and, you know, kind of, like you said, a hierarchy. But I think because I'd been working in drag for, I mean, it's almost 11 years now, I never wanted there to be essentially a hierarchy or, you know, a vibe of one queen is better than the other. So with Machia from day one, when we started 4 years ago, it was everyone is at the same playing field. You know, no kind of bad behavior backstage. We're all having a laugh because I just really want all the performers to have so much fun, and I want the audiences to have fun because you know what it's like. Drag queens have a bitchy stereotype. You know, the queen that picks you out in the audience and makes fun of you. We don't do that at Macchia. Okay. We incorporate everybody. So yeah, what you're essentially going to see in the documentary is myself and 4 out of 10 of the other queens on a little road trip. So we finished our show in Cork, and then we head on down to Tralee because we started over the last year or two bringing it outside of Cork to places like Dublin, Galway, Tralee, which is really exciting to bring it to other towns that might not have that.
And you're the house, and when you say house, it's like German house, is it? H-A-U-S.
Yeah, like H-A-U-S, yeah.
So it's kind of probably has that bohemian sort of feel to it. Completely. In any sense. You're the house mother. Is that what is that you describe that? So could you, this now feels like we're in a convent, you know. But you're the mother and superior. So how does the house mother relate to the others in terms of?
It's essentially like being a normal mother without any of the child benefits. So I don't get anything from the government. But it's basically like imagine if you were starting out and you'd have a mentor. And then you have a protege. So you're just teaching them the different tips and tricks that you've learned over the years.
And Ryan asked Candy if she worries about being in drag when she's out and about.
I won't lie, I would. And I think it depends on the location. And it also depends on who you're with. So if I'm on the way to a gig, I know that once I enter, you know, like a safe queer space, it's going to be nothing but love and fun. But you never know what's going to happen from leaving your house, getting in a cab or walking down the street, because you know what it's like. It only takes one person to say something to you that might throw you off.
Did you get a taxi in here this morning?
I did. Okay. And you know what?
Did you come alone?
No, I didn't. And I did. My lovely friend Erica, who's upstairs, came with me because if I'm in a new city or if I'm, you know, I've never gotten a taxi here before, it's I will just say to a friend, oh, if you want to come. Mm. You know what? If I had to this morning, I would have done it alone. And I've done it in far worse places than getting a taxi to RTE. Yeah. You know, I've gotten on a tube and, you know, in London and gotten to a club on my own. You know, In full drag. But then you're in somewhere like London where it's such a cultural melting pot where you will see queens on the tube. So it just depends. But personally, I don't like to take that risk. So I like to be with people.
I know that one of the things I liked about the program as well was we saw the crew, and I'm thinking it was like now it's like a Tarantino movie, you know, with the gang heading off like a crack squad heading down to Tralee
of all places,
with you know all feathers and hair and heels flying, but in a good way. The pictures of you all as young children I thought were very striking,
really,
because when you're 3 or 4 and you're on your parents' knee or you're playing with the ball or whatever, you know, I was watching going, little do you know as a parent or indeed as a child where the road will end up. And the next thing I see you're on stage and you're doing, you might be a lip sync or just a bit of banter with the crowd. Is being a drag queen difficult on the parents initially?
Yes. I just don't think there's any, you know, getting around that. I would imagine as a parent, a stereotypical Irish parent, you know, they're going to go to school, they're going to go to college, they're going to get married, they're going to work in a bank. Hi, mom, I'm actually going to dress up as a cartoon woman and go on stage to make people laugh. I can't, you know, get upset at any parent for kind of going, that's weird, that's different, I'm shocked. So for my parents initially in the beginning, it was quite tough because it's weird. I can it's strange and it's weird. But I have to say over the years, they've become so supportive and loving. And now we're at the point where I'll walk down and my mom will critique a look. My dad will bring me to a gig and you can't ask for more than that.
Because a lot of people, like we talked in years, I think we're still talking about it, where people have to come out to their parents as being gay.
Of course.
And then
it's like a second coming out.
I was going to say.
It's like a second coming out.
You thought that was interesting?
Oh, well, get ready. Buckle up, baby. Here we go.
Double down. I'm going for it, you know. You know, that must have been, you know,
it was completely weird. And you know what as well? When you're, for me, I started drag just before RuPaul's Drag Race came out. So the only drag I'd really seen was the alternative Miss Ireland on RTE2. Mm. And I was like, what is this? This is amazing. And then I saw Danny LaRue when I was really young. And so that was my influence. So when I was starting, I didn't really go into it going, I'm a drag queen. So I was still figuring it out too, while my parents were going, what the hell are you doing?
So one of the house family was born female. Maud Gone Wrong was on the line from Cork.
Hi, morning. Mod gone wrong. The Queen, the real Queen speaking.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. You said there was no bitchiness, and here we go.
No bitchiness. Sorry, is this your one phone call, Mod?
This is the last phone call.
This is my one phone call, and I've gone round it already.
Mod, tell us a bit about yourself. I was a little surprised because it's all obviously queens as we know them, men dressing as women and what have you. But you, on the other hand, are a woman dressing as a woman. You just like, it's like a hyper version of yourself when you get on stage.
Exactly,
but,
yeah, that's the way I think of it myself,
how,
too.
How did you join the Scooby-Doo squad?
Scooby-Doo gone wrong squad. Yeah, Machia often does, especially when they were setting out first, open mic kind of drag nights. Performance artists can jump up and give things a go. And that's the way I went into it. I had left acting and performing, which I really enjoy, kind of go while I was in college. And I saw this kind of sprout up and thought it was absolutely gas. And was so delighted it was happening in Cork and felt very lucky to have something as weird happening so close to me. So I jumped up thinking it would be a one-night thing, and here I am riding the coattails of Candy Warhol ever since, you know?
What does the show bring to your life, or what does the experience bring to you?
For me, it's just a great outlet, as all good hobbies can be, all good passions can be, but a way for me to completely delve into the kooky fashionista, sometimes bitchy, as you suggested yourself, aspect of my personality without any inhibition, with just letting go of inhibitions and completely getting into the character, enjoying the Irish pop culture skits. These are the things I find funny day to day, makes me delve into them, leave them there, and make me completely neutral and professional in the rest of my life, you know. So it benefits me in all ways, I think.
Do you have another job to speak of?
I'm a manager of a preschool, so many people think there's a very similar set of skills I use day to day, checking on the queens and checking on the kiddies, you know?
Yeah. But largely,
you need a good sense of humour for both, I think, you know?
I'd say very much so. And do you get a kick out of being on stage then when you're out doing your strutting your stuff?
I do. I love it. Yeah, I get a real, real buzz off it. I think anyone who has the cheek to try it is craving that, you know? I love being in skits and performances and dance numbers with the gang, as you call them, with the Machia Queens. And I love, it gives you a chance to kind of delve into those random points of Irish pop culture and analyse them and show them off to the crowd. We all have those memories of Nadine Coyle with Linda Martin on that fateful night during Eurostar. We all have those moments of,
did I see
Twink was led on to the Saturday Night Show again, oh my goodness, you know, and it lets us just all kind of group analyse them as a culture, I think.
Did I see you lip syncing?
Brendan?
No, do not make unnecessary journeys.
Oh, Theresa Mannion, and Theresa Mannion.
That's become so iconic.
Good. And I will say, Ryan, as well, we do a Machia toy show where she does a brilliant Ryan Tuberty.
I do a fantastic Ryan Tuberty.
We'll have to send you that. Maud, you would love it.
I'm going to cut you off there and say, thanks for your time and good luck with that.
I'll tell you,
when you say you do a fantastic Ryan Tuberty, I need to see it and then believe it and then say that's brilliant. But until then, I'm just going to be suspended animation.
Okay. You're quaking in your boots. I'm now nervous.
Maud Gone Wrong for the Ryan Tuberty Show, and Kin of Queens will be available to watch on the RTE Player from Friday, June 25th. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Dr. Marcus Butler is a respiratory consultant at St Vincent's Hospital and medical director at the Asthma Society of Ireland. He was talking about hay fever and how many people have it but don't seek treatment for their hay fever.
This is the campaign, our annual hay fever campaign supported by ALK. And we found that in 30% of our respondents, they're not actually getting help from their healthcare provider in relation to their allergies, even though they're having very frequent symptoms that can certainly upset asthma, for example, and make it more difficult to control and put them at risk sometimes of more serious consequences.
And is it more likely that those with asthma will then also have allergies?
Absolutely. In fact, we found, we estimate about 304,000 people in this country have at the same time asthma and hay fever. Because asthma is very commonly associated with allergy in one of the forms of asthma. Asthma is an umbrella term that we use, but probably the major form is allergic asthma. And these allergens are little microscopic particles that are airborne that can set off reaction in the airways of the lungs in asthma and in the airways of the nose in hay fever.
And what can hay fever lead to? I'm thinking particularly in people with asthma, if it's not treated, if you don't take it seriously and take advice.
Well, if it gets out of control, if it's not medicated or managed, an avoidance of peak levels of these allergens, it can set off the inflammation of the lungs, and the typical asthma symptoms of cough, wheeze and breathlessness and chest tightness can worsen into a full-blown flare-up. And that can land a person out of hours into their emergency department even, and rarely, but tragically, can kill. And about one person a week in this country, unfortunately, succumbs to asthma, which is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. And hay fever is linked to worsening asthma symptoms, and complications of hay fever also linked to worsening asthma, making it often severe. So it's quite important when you have asthma to get your hay fever managed properly.
Now, many people who have hay fever allergies will know the common symptoms, the sneezing, the runny nose, the itchy nose and itchy eyes. But there are a couple of other symptoms, Marcus, that people mightn't be aware of.
That's right. And if patients are ever worried about their hay fever, they can call the Asthma Advice Line 1800 44 54 64 and get lots of information on this. But some of the symptoms include being irritable or being sore throat, hoarseness of the voice. You can end up with headaches from sinus blockage, which is a congestion symptom in hay fever that isn't typically well treated by antihistamines and needs some gentle, safe steroid-based spray treatment to keep it at bay.
Okay. Nora has been in touch and she'd like to know, is there a link between hay fever and menopause? I only got severe tree pollen allergy when I was 50 and now I also have hay fever from grass, etc.
It's hard to say because we don't have very strong evidence of that, but there is certainly a link between hormonal changes and nasal congestion symptoms in pregnancy in later stage. Many women will know well about the rhinitis of pregnancy. It can also get rhinitis actually from oral contraceptive pill in some cases. So hormonal levels can play a role, but it's also something that can just happen at any stage in life. And people are often surprised when it happens later in life, but it's still a very well-known immune reaction in the human body.
Okay. What about hay fever and tiredness? Does it cause tiredness, exhaustion,
fatigue?
It does.
It's one of the lesser well-appreciated symptoms. A lot of people will be putting up with fatigue and ignoring their associated nasal symptoms and not putting two and two together that they're actually linked. And also, apart from being a symptom of hay fever, it can also cause over time nasal congestion and obstruction that can then interfere with sleep, and that can really impact then on concentration, examination performance, work productivity, mood, self-esteem. It can have a really big knock-on effect.
Okay, what about taking antihistamines and then some of them may cause fatigue?
Some of the older generation ones were notorious for this, but the newer generation ones that are widely promoted by healthcare professionals really have very little in the side of that side effect, provided that you dose them in the appropriate way and always follow the package insert advice.
Okay.
Dr. Marcus Butler from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.